Ever wish you could see your way through a problem differently? Or look beyond the obvious and embrace the unexpected? Or find opportunity in disorder? That's dyslexic design thinking. And it's influencing the way we think, create, and relate to one another. Gil Gershoni is the founder and creative director at Gershoni Creative. He's worked with some of the biggest brands in the world. And one of the things he's passionate about rebranding is his dyslexia. In this series, Gil explores the benefits of the dyslexic mindset and the importance of neurodiversity in the creative process. Today, Gil talks to Dr. Fernette and Brock Eide, founders of the Dyslexic Advantage, one of the world's largest online dyslexia communities. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Dyslexic Design Thinking, a series in which we explore the way dyslexia influenced the way we think and create. I'm your host, Gil Gershoni, founder and creative director of Gershoni Creative. Today, we have Drs. Fernette and Brock Eide, best-selling authors and leading experts in the field of dyslexia, who also happen to be husband and wife. Thank you so much for joining us today, Fernette and Brock.
Thanks, Gil, for having us.
First of all, tell us about your backgrounds.
Do you want to go first?
Okay. Well, let's see. You know, I guess by training, I'm a neurologist, and neurology took on a whole different meaning once I became a mom. And I think I became attuned to learning differences and knowing what we know, what we don't know. And it's been a wonderful journey of discovery ever since we had kids and got to know other people's kids and their stories. And now I'm CEO of dyslexicadvantage.org, and it's a wonderful nonprofit organization with a lot of, you know, cool community members and free monthly magazine and a whole bunch of, you know, interesting things for kids as well. And that's pretty much it.
So my medical background is actually in sort of general medical practice and medical ethics and medical humanities. And I also trained for a number of years as a molecular biologist, so pretty broad in different aspects of medicine. And about 25 years ago now, Fernette and I started noticing that our first collaborative project, which was our children, were having interesting and sometimes challenging issues with their own learning. And that was how we first began on this long pathway that's led us to where we are now. And for the last 20 or so years, we've been working together with a clinic and with other projects and writing books on learning differences. And for about the last 15 years, we've really specialized in the area of dyslexia because we found it to be just the most fascinating and enriching field of study and place where we found the most interesting and fun people to work with.
How is it as a husband and wife working on a commercial venture or a nonprofit that matter together? I mean, you know, I also work with my partner, both life and work partners, and that is a creative expression on its own. How are you guys balancing work and work and creativity and writing and all those kind of things?
No problems at all. It's always smooth. I think we've come to sort of the divide and conquer kind of process over time.
Yeah, we learn more about each other. Yeah.
But everything, I think everything we do is an expression of a collaborative process between us. So neither one of us by ourselves would come up with any of the things that we do. Day to day, we do a lot of things separately, moment by moment, but we're constantly stopping to exchange ideas. And so the outputs that we do are different, but the entire process of thinking through what we're doing is 100% collaborative.
And, yeah.
We never do anything.
And I would say that also there is this added dimension of understanding because, you know, there are some things I do very differently from Brock and practice very differently from me. And that was a little eye-opening early on in our relationship, even with courting. You know, but the more we got interested in this kind of metacognition, thinking about your thinking, and then also realizing, you know, that the way you solve a particular problem, the way you perceive certain things can be so different, and that people had not been talking about this. And so I think that's how we became really intrigued by this, because at the time that we first entered the field, I feel like it's really grown a lot in the last two decades. But at the time, we thought that, you know, the medical profession, we were in the scientific profession, we're both on faculty. We thought we should be able to know things. And then lo and behold, we discovered that a lot of this kind of thinking was very skin deep, you know, and that you would learn about learning and it would almost be generic. But then when you actually had, you know, we had controls of ourselves, we could see how differently that we process information, that just became this journey of discovery. And then, you know, a lot of our clinic, in truth, was also motivated. We would ask students how they solve problems, not just see how they solved a problem, but ask them what their experience was. So that, I think that was a huge thing for us, discovering that all along the way, how different we are, you know, how, you know, there are things that sometimes I associated being a quirk, you know, just like he had this long auditory memory. And for instance, I had the auditory memory of a flea. And so I'd be like, why are you listening to radio all the time? Because, you know, it was just, I would forget.
My partner and I also think tremendously differently. And as a dyslexic, she's not. I found that that is actually part of the brilliance of our partnership, you know, is that exactly to your point, is that what she sees, I'm like, how do you see that? I mean, brilliant. You know, here at Dyslexic Design Thinking, we're really interesting about the sort of relationship between dyslexia and creativity. And I know you guys have been writing a lot about the sort of different ways of dyslexia, the views of dyslexia. Can you tell us a little bit more about that in detail?
Yeah, I think our interest in creativity and its relationship to dyslexic thinking is a longstanding one. And it really grew out of our experience clinically working with dyslexic individuals and families. So a lot of our day-to-day work, especially in the early years with our clinic, involved spending time just testing primarily children, but all the way up through adulthood, but asking questions and getting answers to the same questions day after day after day, which in some ways would seem like very uncreative, boring work, but it was actually fascinating because we would get the most interesting and unusual answers to the questions that we asked that showed just this unending amount of variability. And I think it was, for us, the first inkling that there were really two hints that we were dealing with something really different with the dyslexic population. And the first one was just the breadth of the interesting answers, oftentimes that were conventionally considered wrong answers to the questions, that provided interesting insights and really revealed that the mental processes that were involved in coming up with those answers were actually rich and valuable ones, even though they were not the typical ones. The second thing was that because of the nature of our practice, there being two of us, one of us was always out talking with the parents at the same time that the other was in working with the child. And so we tended to get much more in-depth family information and personal background about the children than I think is common in clinical practice. And we kept coming up with the same interesting stories again and again and again about what people and families were doing and the creative things that they were doing professionally and in their hobbies and in their lifetimes, you know, outside of work. And some of these people had an opportunity to have access to good education and good professional opportunities, and some of them didn't. But it was really interesting to see the ways that they found, the avenues they found to express their creativity in those different things. And that's what really first got us interested in creativity and its relationship to dyslexia.
What are some of the questions that you were asking, if you can recall back then, that sort of gave you different answers and unique answers that you said that you considered to be, or traditionally maybe they're perceived to be, incorrect? Any sort of examples on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think common ones would be on picture grouping tasks, for example, on the IQ tests, where you'd have two or three or four pictures and the individual would have to come up with ways of grouping, you know, picking out of a larger set of pictures, the three that went together and coming up with some kind of story about it. Others, we would present kids with a picture of a seemingly kind of random event. It was, I think, you know, one we used commonly was a woman standing at a sink. This is very retro, so I don't want to take any heat for this. I didn't choose the picture.
It's a famous in psychology. It's the cookie thief picture.
The cookie thief picture.
Yeah, so it's famous.
Mom is standing at the sink washing the dishes. The water is overflowing from the sink. Mom is sort of looking back over her shoulder at these two kids that are climbing up on the cabinets, reaching into the upper cabinet to try to get a jar of cookies out. And the kind of depth of the attempts to try to tie together all of the things that were in the picture that were seemingly kind of inexplicable, I think really, really characterized the dyslexic students.
Let me add on to that. Like, for instance, in the case, so you're supposed to write about the picture. You know, a typical sort of creative response, a dyslexic response, would be writing about, like, dad who's not in the picture, but seeing this going on, and then just having this, you know, the motive, it's like the driveway stretches out a long way. And, you know, like, there's nothing about that in the picture. Technically, it's not in the picture, but it's so much about the picture. I mean, that's totally out of the box, right? It's not in the picture, but it provides meaning to the picture.
Typically, we were getting descriptions of the pictures, but with the dyslexic kids, we were getting stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, the characters came to life and they had backstories.
Yeah, they had backstories. To them. Yeah. You know, so funny. There's
prequels to the picture. And it was a totally different kind of experience.
Is that where you guys start to see and kind of come up with your theories around the positivity views of dyslexia to really see that it's more than a learning differences or learning difficulties, but it's just the way the mind works more?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the first thing it did for us is it made us, you know, obviously look at each other and say, you know, are we the only people that are seeing this kind of thing, or have other people noticed this before? And so it led us into the literature to start looking at things. And, you know, one of the books that we found early on was Tom West's book, In the Mind's Eye. And that became a real source of inspiration to us. And then, you know, we searched back all the way as far as we could in dyslexia literature and found really interesting things, even looking at the writings of Samuel Torrey Orton, who was one of the first great dyslexia pioneers, who noticed that one of the first individuals that he examined when he was working at the bizarrely named Iowa Psychopathic Hospital back in the, you know, in the 19-teens, and basically going around Iowa in a covered wagon, testing people that were having problems in different cities. And one of the first people he encountered was a functionally illiterate young person who had basically, they'd given up on them in school. And he started testing him and found that they had really a genius level IQ in the nonverbal domains, but really struggled with reading and had extreme difficulties with a lot of aspects of basic reading skills. And then moving into the 70s and 80s, Norman Geschwind had written some interesting things about the relationship between dyslexia and talent. And some really long-standing workers with dyslexia, basically kind of the old people in the field that had worked for a long time with dyslexia, there was this constant refrain of, you know, I can't always put my finger on it. I can't always define it, but there's something really, really special too about what's going on here in terms of the thinking. It's not just drawbacks. And, you know, over the last 20 years, there have been some people that have actually been doing more formal studies on dyslexia. So we began collecting papers and finding signs of things. And this is really the origin of the Dyslexic Advantage book, where we tried to put together our observations on things we were seeing in the clinic with things that we were reading in these papers and these comments from the old timers in the field.
I have another example. Like, there was a boy who referred to us with severe ADD or something, you know, and when he came in our little area, because we had a home-based practice, I mean, he really, within instants, I mean, it was like seconds, he found probably the most interesting thing in the room. There's these two parabolic mirrors, and then it creates this illusion of a hologram, you know? But, I mean, so he went right to that. There's some kids, you can see them explore the room. I mean, it's not exactly like a test because they don't get a number from it, but, you know, it's interesting when you see people come in the same environment, how they approach it, you know, and he found that right away, and he went right to it, and he started playing around with different things in the little hologram maker. And it's just like, that's another thing. Like, we had the original observation, and then the fact that he was intrigued, which probably made him more in a mood to do testing, because otherwise it just, you know, depends how it's going to be. And sometimes we would make this original observation based on these kids, and then that would make us go to the literature and sometimes dive deeper to answer these questions that seem like it wasn't fully explained by the standard approach to ADD, right? Yeah. So right. A lot of cases, it was very reciprocal between original observation and then finding things in the literature and then helping us find more things in the clinic.
One of the things that we practice, and I wonder if you heard it from some of your research and interview, is around the idea of slowing down so you can move fast. You know, it's almost like if you just drive slower by these towns, you don't need to be a dyslexic and park and get out and forget your agenda for the day, but you do get to actually see a little bit more than you did if you were trying to double down and press any gas and just make it to the nation. And that process has been super useful for us and our clients, because often we try inefficiency to solve a problem, but we forget that actually part of the solving of the problem is to defining the problem. And we jump quickly in the efficient mindset to say that's the problem. And I would say 9 out of 10, it's the wrong problem we're trying to solve. And, you know, usually that process allows us to get to the solution. It takes longer to get there because halfway through you realize you're solving the wrong problem and then you have to pivot, and now it took you twice as long. So have you seen those kind of processes or thinking patterns or approaches from, you know, you've interviewed so many different dyslexics in so many different industries, any sort of consistencies that sort of kind of rises to the top for you guys?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things in terms of the ability of dyslexic thinkers to get non-dyslexic people to think more creatively has been demonstrated, I think, in a number of ways, and sometimes without even recognizing the connections to dyslexia. So, for example, you know, I know at the design school at Stanford, they used and studied some of these processes where they get people to try to think very clearly about past memories in an experiential sense. So we mentioned before about the more lifelike analog type memories. There's been research that's been done at Stanford with the D-School audiences where they've had people go through these exercises of thinking about a particular memory and trying to add back all of these lifelike features. And so, you know, in a sense, what they're really doing is trying to shift people from the schematization into the more analog memory format. And if they do that in advance of brainstorming sessions, then they find out that they end up with much more creative responses from people. And so I think that there's really a growing kind of literature on some of these ways that are tying creativity into things that people with dyslexia do more or less naturally, and that other people have to kind of remind themselves it's time to get off the interstate, you know, let's get out of the car, park, and, you know, and walk. And I think that there's so much that people with dyslexia have to teach. And I love what you've said about being mindful yourself about these different modes of thinking, of being in efficiency mode or being in creativity mode and being in fast mode or slow mode, and however people want to conceptualize it, being really mindful of what you're doing and being metacognitive and kind of aware of the thought processes that are going on. I think this is where we're finally going to see penetration in the corporate communities of true respect for neurodiversity. Because historically, the challenge has been that, you know, all of the people who got where they are by being A-plus students all the way through, you know, Harvard Business School, just have a really hard time imagining that someone who got C's at Middle Valley Community College might be more creative than they are in certain domains. And I think it's really important to create images and ways of communicating what creativity means that people who are from a more conventional analytic academic background can sort of wrap their heads around.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost 5 to 20% of the population are perceived to be dyslexic. And I know, as Frenet, you're saying, like, you know, now the current is changing, you know, that we are starting to see that, you know, we have such strength in different ways that maybe before was not so understood or perceived. You know, how do you see that, you know, there's so many of us that think this way. And as you said earlier, it's an invisible state of mind. It's not, you can't point to it. It's not a disease, not condition. It's not something that affects, but it's so many of us. I mean, how do you see that changing the narrative, you know, as you're thinking about your next book and or the next version of the book? Where are you guys focusing and trying to change that conversation?
Was that to you?
I don't know. You can answer.
So, you know, I think our big focus in this one is pointing to the clear understanding of the way that all of the strengths that we discussed in the first book really seem to arise out of the ability to make certain kinds of connections based on this shift in memory away from exactly the topic you were talking about earlier, away from efficiency and towards a rougher, more lifelike way of thinking about things. And it's very interesting to us that some of the things that we talked about in the first book, you know, some of the structural things like the mini column formation in the brain being more separated. So for those not familiar with the book, it's been found that in the brains of folks with dyslexia, the fundamental processing units, the mini columns in the brain's cortex that form the circuits, are spaced more broadly from each other on average than they are in the general population. While with folks with autism, they tend to be at the opposite end. So they tend to have very tightly packed mini columns. The number of synaptic connections or nerve cell to nerve cell connections that you make declines when you're farther apart, but the length of the connections that you can send out to more distant centers in the brain expands the farther apart you're spaced. And so there are trade-offs in efficiency with being spaced farther apart, but advantages in being able to make more distal connections. And it's become more and more clear with computer simulations and other models that these columnar clusters of nerve cells are really the fundamental units in brain processing. So the differences in dyslexic brain function that kind of distinguish them from the general population can be found at the most fundamental critical aspect of brain processing. So it's I think really important for people to understand that the differences go all the way down and they permeate everything. It's not just reading. It's everything. And it's not that there's a problem in everything. It's that there's a difference in everything. And each of those differences has potential advantages of it. And, you know, if you look at reading, for example, and look at the visual function, which people are getting more interested in now, there's often a central focus problem in people with dyslexia where you have difficulty telling when your eyes are wandering off point. So to make those leaps and then fixations that allow you to clearly see all the letters of the page, it's harder for people with dyslexia. But if you then look at peripheral focus and peripheral attention, you find that it's superior in dyslexia. And if you look at sports leagues, you'll often find that the people that make the really tremendous passes and have what, you know, people consider to be, you know, tremendous court knowledge or field knowledge, they know where everybody is on the field, you'll often find that they're dyslexic. And it's part of a manifestation of having both great spatial sense, but also having tremendous visual peripheral vision. And so there are trade-offs that go all the way through vision. We could do the same thing with sound. We could do the same thing with motor skills. We could do the same thing at kind of every level of cognitive processing. And understanding that people just have these different set points that tune them in to different functional channels is really critical for people to understand.
What I would add to that is, I think what I would like to have come up out of the book is that it gives more people confidence about their strengths. And I think it's really common in the workplace for people not to disclose. But I think the more people find out about their differences and to realize that the differences are not a bad thing, that it gives them more confidence. And ultimately, you know, the typical pattern is in the workplace, once a person knows that other people recognize what they bring to the organization, their talents, their strengths, and everything like that, they're much more likely to disclose, you know, and that has been really powerful. Like, it's great that you look at all the things that have come out of your journey, just being able to develop the Salon series and also have everyone in your organization know about dyslexia from that standpoint. I bet you help coworkers if either they're dyslexic or they have a family member or things like that. And I think it's really powerful for more people to identify, but very few people still tend to identify And I understand why, because society as a whole is pretty ignorant. And there can be a lot of situations where it can be a negative thing if you're actually identified. It can be used against you. And so, you know, my hope is we've seen a lot of progress since our book came out in terms of people disclosing, you know, being much more out there, people who wouldn't disclose even to family members, to spouses, you know, and to children and things like that.
I didn't want to leave before we sort of talked a little bit about you guys' other business. Hard to believe you guys are doing so many different things and your neuro learning. Did I say it right? Neuro learning?
That's right.
And I looked at your site and I was just absolutely curious to kind of hear where you are with it and tell us a little bit about the company.
So the neuro learning was started, hard to believe, about 8 years ago now, and went under a long development process, but it really grew out of our Dyslexic Advantage nonprofit group. One of the things that we realized early on was obviously step one in helping individuals who are dyslexic get more in touch with their strengths and in who they are and what they do well and to find success. It's just to let them know that they are in fact dyslexic. And there was a real lack of opportunity for people to be screened at that time. In the years since, there's been a lot of work to develop screeners for schools, but oftentimes these focus on very young kids. There's a good reason for wanting to intervene early, but there are, as you pointed out, millions of people that are already out there beyond second grade who are dyslexic, that have never been tested, that have never been screened. And those were the people that we were really focusing on, so the ages 7 and older. And the screener, it takes about an hour to do. It can be done on any tablet, smartphone, or anything with a touch screen, iOS, Android, or Kindle Fire. And it will give a very good assessment of the likelihood that an individual shows dyslexic type processing. And then also we have a second mind strength test on there that allows people to look for dyslexia-associated strengths that we've found to be associated with dyslexia through the research that we've done. And so those are all available in our dyslexia screening test app that can be downloaded in any of the app stores.
And do you mention the Bookshare thing? That's kind of cool.
Yes, one of the great things about it is that Bookshare has partnered with us. And Bookshare is a wonderful organization that's headquartered down in the Palo Alto area.
Charity.
Is a 501c3 nonprofit that was founded by a guy named Jim Fruchterman that made one of the early optical speech, text-to-speech readers, and used that money to basically fund work that would provide access to people with visual or dyslexic issues that made it hard for them to read text, access to all the books that are in the Library of Congress, and they haven't quite scanned all of those books yet, but they're rapidly getting there. And you can have free access to download all of these texts, and
so
our app will qualify for membership in Bookshare, which and we're the only app that we're the only screening test that allows.
So that's
you to
do all that. Paid by the federal government. So that's a great thing. Suddenly you can just listen to all these books, you know, because you're identified by the NeuroLearning app. So that's kind of a cool thing. Every year we have a Creative Writing Awards for K-12, and that's kind of a great thing. And there's also STEM Ingenuity Awards in the spring. We like to encourage even kids who don't think that they're writers, they can dictate their stories. And similarly with STEM, we hope that it'll encourage some kids to dabble in science, even if they thought that they may not be particularly good at science, because, you know, chances are they might be really good at science. You know, a lot of students really are. And we just wanted to create that opportunity. We give away little cash prizes and ribbons and things like that. And we really just want to encourage these things in the next generation.
Wow, that is so wonderful. It sounds like there is a lot of things coming up for you guys. All so exciting. Thank you both, Drs. Barak and Frenet, ID of the Dyslexic Advantage, for spending the time with us today. It's really, really moving to be part of this global community that embraces different minds. And I'm personally looking forward to reading the new book that's going to be coming out early 2023. Thank you so much for listening to our show today. If you haven't yet, please get yourself a copy of Dyslexic Advantage wherever books are sold. And subscribe to Dyslexic Advantage's newsletter at dyslexicadvantage.com, which has some great dyslexia learning resources and stories. I'm Gil Gershoni, and you've been listening to Dyslexic Design Thinking.
If you enjoyed our conversation today, be sure to subscribe to this series wherever you get your podcasts and follow along on Instagram at Dyslexic Design Thinking. You can also drop us a line at dyslexia@gershoni.com to receive our monthly newsletter and learn more about our upcoming programming. Dyslexic Design Thinking is produced by Gershoni Creative. Until next time, be well.